This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association, a half-hour program featuring interviews and commentaries relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. I'm your host, Jay Schell. We are talking today with George Werthner, professional photographer, writer, and ecologist. George has written more than 24 books on natural history and other environmental topics. He's currently the Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. So welcome, George. With wildfires raging in California and western Montana and elsewhere right now, presumably due to climate change and global warming, what's your reaction to what's going on?
Well, the main thing, it's a good thing that you point out about the climate change, because that is a contributing factor to the large wildfires. All large wildfires are affected by a number of factors, one being drought, which climate change is exacerbating, higher temperatures, which climate warming is exacerbating, higher winds, which often are associated with climate change, and then low humidity, which goes with drought and so forth. So those factors are all being increased as a result of climate change, which sets up the situation for large fires.
It seems like we're seeing larger and actually more frequent and earlier fires than in the past. So is it true that we're experiencing more and larger fires?
It depends upon, there's a shifting baseline in this, and it's important to understand and acknowledge that. Relative to a lot of the last century, in other words, 1900 through 2000, there was a period of time in the middle of that when it was cooler and moister. And then starting in the 80s, it got hotter and drier and so forth, 1988 being a classic with Yellowstone. And so relative to those decades earlier to that, the 1940s and 50s and 60s, and 70s, it's, yes, we are seeing larger fires and things like springs coming earlier and so forth. If you go back in time, just even to the beginning of the last century, like the 1910 burn that burned over 3.5 million acres of Idaho and Montana, we have had nothing like that yet. And that was a period of time when it was warmer and drier than that middle part of the century. And then if you go back 1,000 years, there was a medieval warm spell that was actually warmer and drier than currently, but and many large fires. So it kind of depends upon where you are in that cycle. But the one thing that is true is we are contributing carbon to the atmosphere, which contributes to the warming. And the trends are that we're just going to see a lot more of that.
So several years ago, I read Norman McLean's book, Young Men and Fire, about the Mann Gulch fire in 1949 that was up northeast of Helena. It was a blow-up in which 13 firefighters were killed. So how did that affect the way, I thought that was a pivotal event, and I wondered how that affects the way fires are fought.
Well, that event and the death of firefighters in Colorado as well have made the agencies doing the firefighting much more cautious about being aggressive in putting people near or in front of fires. And the way that firefighting is typically done now is, or they try to do, is to pick a strategic place where there's a ridge top, a place where there's maybe a lot of roads where they can get the equipment in, and make a stand there rather than, okay, the fire's burning over here, but we're not going to jump over there necessarily. We're going to try to get ready for it and try to stop it at this strategic point. So that's a change that's happened as a result of these firefighter deaths.
Yeah, those Mann Gulch firefighters, 12 of the 13 were parajumpers. Who jumped onto the fire.
And they got trapped with it. What happened was, and this is what often happens, is they the fire got behind them, and they were trapped between a fire front in front of them and behind them with no place to go. And that's how come they died.
So what's been the evolution of fire science and the way as fires are fought? What did they do back around 1900 In order to deal with fires.
Well, around 1900, I would say that for the most part, they weren't very effective at fighting fires. You know, that's in the days when most of the, a lot of the West was still roadless, mm-hmm. you know, and you jump on a mule and you head in with a bucket and a shovel and you try to put out fires. And this gets to an important point. We often hear there's been 100 years of fire suppression. And I would argue that it was very ineffective in the early days, except maybe around communities and places where you could get to a fire soon. And there's been some research that shows that the vast majority of fires will go out on their own, whether we do anything or not. And I think what we take credit for putting out those fires and say it's fire suppression when, in fact, you know, maybe they were going to go out. For example, they did for a while in Yellowstone prior to 1988. They had a policy of letting some backcountry fires burn. And my numbers might be off a little bit, but it generally, as I recall, there were like 235 wildfires in the backcountry. 222 of them burned less than 5 acres, and they all went out on their own, which suggests, again, you know, we would have gone to those fires and put them out, and we would have said, oh, we put them out, when in fact they probably weren't going to go anywhere.
So what sparks or causes those large fires?
Well, and that's...
How do we go about controlling them?
The large fires are not controllable. That would be the point I would make. Particularly winds are a key ingredient. When you have high winds, this is what's happening. You're blowing burning embers in front of the fire front. They've recorded burning embers going more than 10 miles in some places, but 1 to 2 miles would still be considered a lot. So you make a fire line, even with bulldozers and stuff like that, and the embers just get blown right over that kind of thing with the wind. So until the wind dies down or the humidity goes up a whole lot or it starts to rain or something like that, you have a hard time controlling those fires. When I was researching a book about the Yellowstone fires, I remember reading this typewritten report that was done back in the 1930s. And the guy writing the report, with no sense of irony, said, "We finally got the fire under control, had a hell of a time breaking camp in the rain." And had no seemingly connection between the two of those factors.
Yeah. So are any suppression methods viable?
Well, the one thing that's used commonly is to burn out the vegetation before the fire approaches that area. That's being the strategic firefighting that you see. Depending upon, you know, how much the wind is blowing, and sometimes the wind changes and it blows back on them. Apparently, the wildfire that burned around Cook City in 88 was a back burn that was set, and the wind changed direction and came back right around Cook City. So it's risky, but that's one of the techniques that are used a lot.
Yeah, I've wondered if backfires really, really work, or if sometimes they get out of control.
They sometimes do, yes. And then the other thing about those is some of the people that I've read or know say that a lot of the acreage being burned, at least a percentage of it, is due to the firefighting itself. In other words, if you had a 500,000-acre fire, which is a very large fire, you know, maybe a third of that might be due to firefighting fires that were set on purpose. And depending upon where they are, they may exacerbate some of the you know, issues, like if it burns through old growth forest or something that maybe it wouldn't have otherwise.
So one of the issues that's been under discussion for a long time is whether or not thinning does any good, whether by removing some of the undergrowth you can forestall fires taking over.
All right, there's several nuances to answer that question. The first thing that you have to realize is fires burn fine fuels. That's what burns in a fire, which is why you have snags left over. So removing big trees doesn't really reduce the thing that's burning in a forest fire. Uh-huh. It's the fine fuels, the needles, the cones, the small branches, and that sort of thing. The second thing that happens, if you get back to what I said about the factors that cause or help to spread fires, which includes higher temperatures and low humidity and wind, often when you thin a forest, you open up the forest to more drying and of the fine fuels, and you also open it up for easier wind penetration. So you may have the opposite effect. And there are any number of studies that show, for example, that the really dense forests, because they're cooler and moister, are actually the patches that often don't burn in a forest fire. And a way you can think about this, fuels, you know, there's this whole emphasis on fuels, which I think is misplaced. Not that you've got to have, obviously, some fuels, but take a look at, say, the coastal forests in Washington, Olympic National Park, which has the number one biomass of all forests in North America. There's more biomass in a single acre of the Olympic forest there than there is in 100 acres here in Montana, but it hardly ever burns because it's too moist and too cool most of the time because it's right next to the ocean to burn well. So that shows you indirectly how the climatic and weather conditions have a great influence on how things will burn. So the other thing about thinning is it tends to be short-lived in terms of reduction of the fine fuels, because the other thing that happens is you reduce competition. So now you have a growth of shrubs and grasses and small trees, all of which are the fine are the ingredients that help to spread a fire. So my response is thinning has to be strategic. I would advocate thinning around houses, around community edges of communities and so forth. But in a lot of places, it isn't going to help at all, and it may actually make things worse.
So what then are the ecological costs of thinning and logging?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because that's the other part of the equation. Yeah. Is that, for example, logging roads are a big source of sedimentation in streams that affects fisheries. You have the spread of weeds on logging roads and the disturbance from the ground. That may be longer term impact to a forest ecosystem, the weeds that get established, than the fact that the trees burn up or don't burn up. Yeah. And then you have things like disturbance of wildlife, that are sensitive to human entry. You create more access. You have reduction in biomass, which actually is not necessarily good from a wildlife point of view. Dead snags and trees are really important for a lot of different animals and so forth. So there are definitely ecological impacts that result from the logging that that are often overlooked or not counted in assessments.
You mentioned wildlife, and I want to ask, how's wildlife cope with a burning or a burned forest?
Well, that's another interesting thing. There are a lot of wildlife species that benefit from a fire. A good example, I'll start up large and go on down. For example, elk, with all the grass and shrubs that come in after a fire will often increase. So a good example of that is the burns that happened over in Idaho and the Selway country. Some of the the largest elk herds in Idaho were located there until the trees grew back. And then you go on down through the ecosystem, birds. 45% of all bird species rely on dead trees at some point. Oh, they might be roosting in them, may be feeding on them. It's not just woodpeckers. Robins and bluebirds are some of the most abundant birds you'll see after a fire. And then we go down, native bees increase after a fire because you get all these flowers and stuff. Ants, which support a lot of smaller animals, or even grizzly bears feed on ants some of the time. So who wins and loses, like in anything, varies, but it's not an error. One more point. A lot of fish increase after a fire because of all these nutrients and logs that go into a stream, which creates better habitat.
But fires also result in erosion, and that can occlude streams, right?
It can, but this is another thing where the research comes out and sort of negates some of that, in that there will often be a pulse of sedimentation right after a fire, but you get such quick recovery if you don't have disturbance with logging roads and so forth, which are a chronic source of sedimentation, that they found within 3 to 5 years, the sediment levels go down back to pre-fire or erosion, or even less than there was before the fire, depending upon the situation. So, the fish can deal with a year or two where they miss spawning, but most fish live more than 1 or 2 years. Yeah. And in fact, the gravels that often come in with a fire actually increases sometimes spawning habitat. So, you know, initial reduction, but then increase in usually larger fish. And another thing that's interesting, because the aquatic insects go up after a fire in these streams, you also get an increase in bats and birds along the creek from all the insects.
So what are the effects of erosion? How long-lived is the erosion effect? How soon does vegetation come back in?
It depends upon what was there previously. A lot of grasses and shrubs, depending upon which shrubs we're talking about, come back from the roots because the heat rises. It doesn't kill below the surface usually. It's amazing. You go to Chaparral in California, within a couple of years, you can hardly tell a fire burned through that. Or in a lot of these grassy slopes that you would have around Bozeman and Meadows, within a few years, they're as dense or denser than they were prior to the fire. On the other hand, if you go into an area that was a real close canopy forest, you may not have much in the understory before the fire. And then the fire comes in and there isn't much to grow back yet. It takes a while for seeds to colonize it, so it can take a longer time.
So you advocate the let it burn philosophy?
Yeah. As a rule, yes. There's two things that I would say with that. One, the fires have a lot of beneficial effects that are not appreciated by a lot of people. And the second thing is that we pretty much can't stop the fires that are burning during extreme weather conditions, which every large fire that happens in the West burns under those conditions. So the fires that we can stop or do something about are the smaller ones that are not burning under extreme conditions, but then they're never going to burn a whole lot of acreage anyway. So we are, in a sense, in my view, spending a lot of time trying to do something that's not very effective.
And dollars as well.
We're spending a lot of money fighting these fires that most, even a lot of firefighters, if you could get them, you know, privately, even though they like the money they're making, they would say, we know that we can't stop the fire under these conditions. We ought to be just back in camp playing cards. But of course, the public would never stand for that. So they go out and they have, you know, slurry bombers dropping stuff and helicopters flying all over. And a lot of that they know is not going to have an effect until the weather conditions change. And then if they jump on it, they can maybe make a difference, especially if they've been, you know, strategic about it. The other thing, though, what's contributing to the rising cost of firefighting throughout the country is the majority of money is being spent protecting structures anymore. And you get into whether you're in Montana or especially someplace like California, where you have so many houses built up into fire-prone ecosystems, that's where the money is spent trying to protect those few structures or sometimes whole cities. But that costs a lot of money, and that's where they're spending their time on it. And the other irony is that the structures being built in the wild, what they call the wildlands urban interface or out in the woods, are often the factors that contribute to fires, because the majority of fires, particularly in California, are human started. And they have to do with everything from, it's a windy day, like I said, which starts big fires, and it blows a tree down on a power line. The power line starts the fire. Mm-hmm. A lot of the big fires, the one that Santa Rosa you mentioned before we came in, and others, were started by that kind of event. And then, so the more power lines you have out there, the more likely you are to have that happen. Cars, sparks from cars and chainsaws, all sorts of things. The more humans you got out there, the more likely you are to get a fire, the more likely you get a fire under conditions that are hard to stop them.
So would you advocate government restrictions, zoning restrictions, on where homes are built adjacent to areas that are fire prone?
Yes, exactly. In fact, two important points. One, Oregon has statewide zoning. You cannot build outside of an urban growth boundary. So every town, even a little town, like say something like Clyde Park here in Montana, would have to have a plan about where all the growth is going to occur, and it has to be concentrated there. And that doesn't mean that there aren't houses in the woods, because there were houses built before the law was passed, but it certainly reduces that effect. Another example is up in Alberta, Canmore, which is right adjacent to Banff National Park, has very strict laws. They go around and inspect your house every year and say, you know, you've got needles on your roof, or you've got firewood against the house, or whatever. You got to do something about that, or we'll do it and charge you for it. You know, that's if you're living in a fire-prone area, you really need that because, and this is the very important part, even if you reduce the flammability of your home, if your neighbor doesn't, if a burning ember lands on his house and it starts his house on fire, he's going to burn your house down probably. So it has to be a community effort. Otherwise, you're likely to have a failure as a result.
I have a material on my roof, which I believe is fire resistant. It's some kind of a plastic or composite material. And I've wondered if there were a fire raging near my house, is my house less vulnerable to burning down because of the roof?
Exactly. In fact, what the research suggests is that if you have a non-flammable roof, preferably a metal roof, but non-flammable material, you have a 95% chance of surviving a high-severity fire. And the reason is a wildfire is a huge pulse of heat, but it's short-lived because it's being driven by wind. And if there's nothing flammable that can catch on fire immediately, it passes the house. Whereas if the house has something that's flammable, then that creates an ignition source that lasts right at the house, mm-hmm. and then will set the house on fire.
So how would you recommend reducing costs of firefighting generally across the system?
Well, the most important thing, I think, is reducing the flammability of homes and communities. And you would do that in several ways, as I've already mentioned. One, having the best way would be mandatory structure changes so that everybody has a, you know, metal roof or non-flammable roof. Doing things like prescribed burning right on the edges of towns that increases the ability of firefighters, even on a windy day, to maybe stop a fire. To make sure that you, encourage the planting of trees and shrubs that are less flammable. Evergreens are more flammable than deciduous trees. So, you know, if you're going to have trees in your yard, aspen is going to be a good thing. I went and looked at the Thomas flower down in Santa Barbara last January, just a month after it happened. And the interesting thing I saw was these orange groves that flanked a lot of the towns like Ojai and Ventura didn't burn. They were a real good fire break because they're so green and they're irrigated and so forth. And the fire couldn't penetrate that, even though this was a massive fire. Mm-hmm. So the vegetation you put in your community can make a big difference too.
So would you advocate local restrictions or statewide or federal restrictions on how people must protect their properties?
Well, you know, it would seem to me that at the very least it probably needs to be state and in some sort of consistent pattern. Because as I said, if I do it for my house and my neighbor doesn't do it, it really isn't going to help me. So there has to be something that's some consistent policies. The other thing that's happening indirectly in California anyway, I just had a friend of mine told me he had his insurance policy canceled after 28 years because they said, you live in too risky a place and we're not insuring you anymore.
Wow.
And that is going to be more and more common as wildfires become bigger, and particularly in places like California.
Yeah, right.
And so that can help, you might say, encourage people to change their patterns. Mm-hmm. But really, we're all paying for these firefighting events, including putting people's lives at risk.
Yeah.
And, another thing that needs to be done in communities, it depends on the community, but just an emergency plan. What are you going to do if there's a fire? Think of something like the Gallatin Canyon. If there was a massive fire there and Big Sky had to get out of there, there would, a lot of people there, and I don't know where they're going. Let's say their fire blocked the canyon on both ends. Well, maybe they go over Jack Creek, over into the Ennis area, but they may not know about it. So there should be signs and a plan that everybody has worked out for emergencies, because sooner or later it's probably going to hit.
Very good. Well, George, thank you very much. This has been very interesting. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. We've been speaking with George Werther, professional photographer, writer, and ecologist. You've been listening to Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association. I'm Jay Schell.